This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
To UC San Diego's OSHA Lifelong Learning Distinguished Lecture Series. Today's distinguished lecturer is former Mayor Jerry Sanders. Well, Mayor Sanders was a senior at San Diego State University. He joined the San Diego Police Department and rose to the position of Chief of Police in 1993. In the private sector, he was a founding partner and consultant for high-tech startup companies involved in homeland security and infrastructure assessments. In 2005, he was elected mayor of San Diego, and he was the first mayor of a strong mayor system. He was elected to a second term in 2008 and left office in 2012 due to term limits. Following that, the very next day, he became president and CEO of the San Diego Chamber of Commerce. Ladies and gentlemen, Mayor Sanders.
Well, I do want to tell Stanley thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. And you can't embarrass me, so you can ask any question in the world. After having been a politician for 7 years, there is literally nothing that I haven't heard, at least I think. I just wanted to start out. I have been very lucky, and I know many of you have probably been in San Diego as long, but I moved down here in 1970 to go to San Diego State University and spent a lot of time there, far more than anybody anticipated, of course. But I left San Diego State in my last semester as a senior to join the San Diego Police Department in 1973. And I just had the best career I could possibly imagine. Being a cop is probably about the most fun you can possibly have. It was a really rewarding experience. And what was nice about the San Diego Police Department was all the opportunities I had to work different places. I never worked more than 2 years in any place. I worked all over the city. Worked in different divisions. I was on the SWAT team for 7 years and the SWAT commander for 2 years. Had an opportunity to become the commander of the San Diego Police Academy and then to start moving up in the ranks as a captain and commander. And I don't know about the commander rank. I was the last commander they ever promoted. They eliminated the position, which tells you how valuable that was. And then I became an assistant chief and worked in nearly every division the assistant chiefs worked in, including internal affairs and budget. Had a field command, which was the entire city. And then finally became chief of police in 1993. And I just had the most unbelievable experience as chief of police for 6 years. We were able to institute a style of policing that I think literally led the United States. And the reason I can say that, it wasn't me. We had an opportunity, and we had been very active with the federal government in terms of getting grants to explore new policing styles. And one of those grants was problem-oriented policing, and another was neighborhood policing. And we literally kind of transformed the way we policed in the 1990s. And I'll just give you a few points on that so you can get the context for it. The year before I became police chief, we had 165 homicides in the city of San Diego, which was a lot. That was the highest we'd ever had. That was during the time when cocaine and all the other drugs were really hitting the streets hard in San Diego, a lot of gang activity. We had not experienced that type of thing before. When I left in 1999, that year we only had 42 homicides. And every other crime category went down commensurately. And what happened was when I became chief, I had a crystal clear vision of where I wanted to take the police department in terms of neighborhood policing, in terms of problem-oriented policing. And what we did was we put together a group of rank and file, a group of police officers, community members, all the way up, but really heavily represented by police officers out on the street. They came up with a model which was much better than anything I had thought of. They literally put together a model that they thought would work and that the community thought would work, and my crystal clear vision went out the window, and I adopted what they came up with. Those officers became the instructors around the country. which was probably the first time we've sent officers to do the instruction with other police departments and with the National Institute of Justice and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. But it was literally the rank-and-file police officer on the street who became the experts in this style of policing. And what they did was they started engaging the community. They started working with the community. And we had through the community, we had giant forums all over the city, asked them what they wanted to see out of their police department, what a good police department would look like. We also asked them what their neighborhoods look like. Their neighborhoods were very different than the boundaries we had arbitrarily drawn over the years. So we went to a model that instead of having 42 beats, we went to one with 106 communities in San Diego, self-named by each of those communities. And those communities held meetings either weekly or every other week or monthly, depending on how they felt about crime in their neighborhood. And they would bring the police officers in. And the police officers, it was a training thing that went on at first, because the first meeting we went into and asked the community what they wanted from us, they wanted everything solved the next day. And that's simply not doable, and it wasn't something that was realistic. And we said, you're going to have to come up with priorities as a community. You're going to have to tell us exactly what you want us to work on, and then we'll work on those things. But you're going to have to give us very specific information also. If it's a drug location in your neighborhood, we need to know what times the drugs are being sold. We need to know out of which door or window. We need to know when you're seeing people there. And as we started to build a trust in neighborhoods, that's exactly what we would get. And the police officers would come back after a week or 2 weeks to the next meeting, and for the first time, they'd give the communities feedback on what they'd actually done. Prior to that, police officers prioritized themselves. They decided which were the most important issues for a neighborhood. And then they always went and solved things that were high on a police officer scale, like robberies and burglaries, things like that, not the neighborhood types of things that destroy the fabric of a community. When you started working with the community, you found out they didn't care if the bank at the shopping center got robbed. It didn't mean anything to them. What mattered to them was speeding in their neighborhood, was a drug sales in the neighborhood, some type of disorder in the neighborhood, something that really affected them on a personal level. And so our officers reoriented the way that they started looking at policing. So that's exactly what they did, is what the neighborhoods wanted them to do. And they would go back in a continuous feedback loop and let them know if they were successful, let them know if they weren't successful and whether their information they needed, whether the thing had popped up again. A lot of drug houses will go out of business and they'll pop up two houses down. Because of the renters. But we were very successful in that. And what we found was crime started going down fairly dramatically. And by the end of the 6 years I was there, and it's gone even lower since then, crime declined by 49% in the city of San Diego. And that is really the community's effort and the reason that I think that this model works so well. It was the community that decided that crime was going to go down, and they worked on it very hard. The biggest difficulty I had as chief was transferring one of those officers out of a neighborhood. The neighborhoods became identified with the police officers that were there. They'd invited them over for dinner. They were there for social activities. They were there all the time. And when we needed to move somebody, because on a police department with 2,000 officers, you need to move them around, you need to promote them, you need to do other things, it became very difficult because the community becomes so attached to the people who are working with them on a daily basis. And I think that's a good problem to have. We saw complaints about police officers plummet by about the same amount, by about 50%. We saw the satisfaction in the city used to do a satisfaction survey, and the only people we came out with a lower satisfaction rating was the fire department. And that's because they come and squirt some water on your house and then clean up and leave. And everybody loves firefighters. We had about a 90% approval rating, and I really attributed that to the fact that probably 10% of the people we'd either arrested or they belonged to a mother or a father or a cousin or an aunt or an uncle, and they weren't happy with us, and I understood that completely. So we were very happy with that. Our burglaries went down by 50%. Our auto thefts went down even more dramatically as we started really looking at the causes of those. And it really encouraged police officers to become much more innovative in how they were dealing with things. So we had a neighborhood orientation with a problem-oriented policing approach. And the problem oriented policing approach was developed by Herman Goldstein at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He was pretty much the dean of that. It was a very specialized process where you went through four steps. You identified a problem, and a problem had to be two or more instances. So it wasn't just one. It had to be a pattern. Number two, you had to actually analyze the problem, which is something police officers have never done. So you'd find out why one house on a block was attractive to kids hanging out for drug sales, for whatever. And then you'd pick a customized approach to handling that situation so that you had an opportunity to remove pieces from that. And what we found is if you removed pieces from that problem, you had a good chance of solving the problem. For instance, if you had an absentee landlord that continually rented out to drug dealers, we would take that absentee landlord, we would warn him, we'd try to engage him, but finally we'd go to court and try to take the house away from him or for at least 12 months so that they would stop that pattern. And that happened in a lot of situations. My favorite example, there was a gas station at Imperial and Euclid, literally hundreds of calls. And what we asked our officers to do is go after your highest volume calls. Find out where those are. If you can solve that, then you're creating a lot of time for you to work on other problems. So we would give them lists of locations that had huge volumes of calls. We found this gas station. They would call several times a night saying there was a fight on the parking lot, there was a disturbance on the parking lot, there were people that looked like they were casing the gas station. The officers started really focusing on that, and they would be across the street when calls would come in, and they could look across the street and see that there was not a fight on the parking lot when the call came in. They could see there was no disturbance over there, and finally they went over and contacted the manager of the parking lot or the gas station and said, "Why do you continue to call us when there's nothing going on here?" And that person said, "I'm afraid to be here. And my management company said if the police had to respond all the time, he'd hire a security guard." So there was no crime occurring in that location, and we had police officers from the entire area responding over and over and over again. And with simply talking to that manager and saying, "You cannot call the police just because you're frightened," they were able to solve probably 500 radio calls a year, which takes two officers to go to. We had instance after instance of things just like that, and I think that's really what set our department out in front. At the same time, New York PD went to their zero tolerance model exactly the same time. Zero tolerance in New York City meant that they arrested everybody for even minor infractions. Threw something on the ground, they'd arrest you. Any type of disturbance, they would arrest you. Very different model from engaging the community to one where they literally became like an army in the neighborhood, and it worked really well for 5 or 6 years. And then all of a sudden, you'd arrested everybody's father or brother or cousin, and people were really upset. They had exactly the same drop in crime that we did during that 6-year period, 49%. Now, what that shows you is there's different ways to get there. It also shows you that New York City was 7 million people. They had 39,000 police officers at the time. San Diego, with 1.3 million people, had 2,000 police officers. So they had literally almost triple the number of police officers we did, and yet it came out the same drop in crime. And I think what that told us was if you engage the community, you don't need to have more police officers, which are extremely expensive in any city. So that's what we learned from that. The police department to this day still continues with many parts of that. They got down into the 30s in homicides, which is unheard of in a city of 1.4 million people, the eighth largest city in the United States. And I think the officers still take great pride in engaging the community on doing things like that. 1999, my wife decided that I hadn't watched my daughters grow up. They were in high school, and it was time to do something else. And she'd also, my wife is an interesting person. She grew up very poor in Brooklyn. She worked her way through Barnard College and got her degree. Got a mayoral fellowship for Ed Koch in the City Hall of New York, and decided she wanted to do something meaningful, so she went on the New York City Police Department. She was a cop on the streets. Now, my wife's also Jewish, and there's a great story about this. New York City, when they were doing their backgrounds, they don't do polygraphs, which was probably part of their problem from time to time. But she was in the interview process and was in the hiring process, and they said, "We can't hire you. We got really a bad recommendation for your last employer." And she said, "I worked for my aunt and my grandmother." And they said, "You mean Elizabeth Sampson?" And she said, "That's my grandmother." And so they said, "Well, she said you weren't a very good employee." And when she went to talk to her grandmother said, "Jewish girls don't become police officers." So my wife went on to a career in policing. She went on NYPD. She bought drugs undercover in Harlem, in Spanish Harlem, all over the city. She's far tougher than I am, believe me. She made sergeant after 3 years, which on New York City Police Department is pretty unusual. And then after 5 years, she decided to take a leave of absence, and she went to Harvard Law School, just like all cops do. She worked her way through Harvard Law School, got her law degree, practiced law for a year. New York City Police Department fired her because she wouldn't come back in her last semester of law school. So she practiced law for a year, paid off her debt, and then hated practicing law. So she went to a policing think tank called the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington, D.C., and that's where I met her. But she is very well-known in policing circles. She's probably written about 15 or 20 publications for the National Institute of Justice. But she had had a lot of experience watching police chiefs get so full of themselves that they drug a police department down, they ruined their reputation before they could leave. And she just said, "That's not going to happen in our house. You're going to get out while you're on top, and you're going to pay some attention to our daughters." So in 1999, I went to the United Way of San Diego County as the CEO there and just had a great time. I was there 3 years. Once again, putting a good team together is always what matters because it's the team that does it. They were able to raise fundraising by about 20% at a time when all the United Ways were declining. And from there, I moved on to go into business with a friend. That's another story completely. Unless you know your friend really well, don't ever go into business with one. But at that same time, the Red Cross kind of went off the tracks, and the national chapter stepped in and fired the CEO of the Red Cross, fired the entire board of directors, which is the first time in history that's ever happened. And they asked me to come in as an interim board member, reconstitute a board, and hire a CEO. And so I did that for a couple of years as a volunteer, and it was a very rewarding experience watching Admiral Ronnie Froman take that organization, really shake it and do an incredible job as she moved forward. And then I think I keep my ego in check pretty well. But in 2005, some people said, "The mayor's going to resign, and you need to think about running." And, you know, that's kind of – your ego kind of gets wrapped up in that. And I made the fatal mistake of saying, "Okay, I will." And that started a different chapter in my life and one that I never tell people I was a politician. I always tell them I was a police chief. It's just a very different existence. And until you actually run in an election and you have people targeting you and you can say anything you want about the individual – you can talk about that individual any way that you want. You'll never know what it feels like to run for office, especially a high-profile office like mayor. So in 2005, I started that. I didn't know anything about politics, and I can't claim to be real smart in that still. But some good people got involved and helped me out. And I have to tell you, you learn a lot in politics that you never realized. So I always thought letters to the editor were actually written to by people like you. Well, they're not. Now, you may get a few normal letters in, but those are people in campaigns that simply write letters to either support you or bash the other candidate or talk bad about you. All very orchestrated. Everything you see is orchestrated behind the scenes by somebody, one side or the other. It's a very intense existence, and it's a very intense sport. And as much as I disagreed with Donna Fry, I will always respect her because she ran and was always willing to speak out. I think that's a valuable thing, and you have to respect people who do that because she got smacked around really well by people and by press. I got smacked around pretty well. And, you know, as a cop, you're used to people coming up and being very direct with you to your face. If you're out in a neighborhood, people will tell you exactly what they think about you. They have no problem with that at all. if you're the chief of police, cops will tell you exactly what they think about you. And each one of them thinks they should be in your job. That's just the way it works, and that's a good thing. But in politics, it usually comes sideways or behind or from another place. You never know where it's going to come or why it's coming. And that's one of the things that really startled me when I started running. And so we ran in a primary that was a special election, raised $500,000, and that was 250 was the limit, and nobody else could contribute. So corporations couldn't contribute. There were no PACs, political action committees. Very different time, and the limit set by the Ethics Commission was $250. So raising $250 a person and getting that up to $500,000 to run the campaign, you can imagine how that is. Held 75 different fundraisers. There were 75 different forums or debates, something I had never been involved in before. And then to come out of the primary and have to do it exactly again the same way was really a different exercise for me, and I think it gave me a much better appreciation for what candidates go through when they're doing this. I was elected in December of 2005. On January 1st, we switched from a city manager form of government to a strong mayor form of government, one nobody had any experience in. So I went from being the ninth member of a city council and running a council meeting in December to becoming the strong mayor in January. You don't go to council. You don't have a vote. It's a very different role, and there was really nobody there to explain how we did that. The ballot initiative that passed the strong mayor, and I, by the way, I signed with Donna Frye in opposition to that because I didn't think it was good to inject politics into department directors and all that, where you fire them all when you come in, like most cities. New York, new mayor, new everything, new police commissioner, new fire commissioner. Every department director is removed and other people are brought in. So I didn't think that was a good way to do business. But we had gotten in so deep in trouble having a city manager form of government that I don't know there's another way you could do it, to be very honest. The way it worked before, and Jack McGrory is one of my best friends, really admire him. The city manager that came after him, though, didn't quite understand how to work the same levers that Jack did. But with a city manager like Jack McGrory, the council members, when he had to take a budget forward, they'd say, we don't want to do this in public. We want you just to give it. You do the budget. We don't want to see any tax increases, and we want to improve services. Now, that's you can't get there from here. Jack, being very smart as a city manager, would leave a certain amount of money for each of those individuals to spend on their neighborhoods and then start working on the on getting that budget through. That can only go on so long, and what happened was after Jack left, in the city of San Diego, if you're going to not make your retirement payment, the payment for the retirement system, if you're not going to make that, you have to have a vote of the employees to allow you not to make that payment. So this is the cycle that got us into the trouble we were in. The payment was not being made. The employees agreed with that because in order to agree with it, they'd have to get better benefits or else they wouldn't vote for it. So they got better benefits, reduced age at retirement, and what we call the DROP program. The DROP program, which it means you can retire at age 50 and still work for 5 years and collect your salary and your retirement, although it goes into an account, was only designed for police officers at the line level and firefighters at the line level. And that's because there was a big drain on those, and it's very hard to hire police officers. Firefighters will normally stick around. There's a huge line out the door to take the firefighting test, but public safety has always pretty much been together. What happened, though, was the other people in the city said, that is a tremendous benefit. We want that, too. So first it was other employees in the city, and then it was the management in the city. Never designed for management. Nobody was ever supposed to leave the city with $1 million in a retirement account on top of their retirement. And that's what really started ringing the bells. That and the fact that while a pension payment, the year I became mayor, was $135 million, they'd only paid $35 million a year before. only paid $35 million the year before that. And as the stock market started to expose that it was weak, we found out that the payments had not been made, and all of a sudden you've got a huge deficit. And the only way you secure that deficit is by making larger payments. And that's exactly what we had to do. We made a $135 million payment the first year. It went up from there because they'd also been paying for health care for the employees out of that. They've been paying retiree health care, none of which was supposed to happen. And the IRS stepped in and said, you have to pay that back. So our payments ramped up considerably. And that's what caused us to be on the brink of bankruptcy, was literally the retirement system and how that had been done. Now, the other thing that happens when you have a city manager form a government is if you want to pass a budget, then you simply pass it and you inflate the revenue. So you say, even though we get pretty sophisticated revenue analysis, they'll say sales tax in the city of San Diego is going to go up 2% next year. Well, if you're a city manager, you say it's going to go up 3%, which gives you literally tens of millions of dollars more. If you say property tax is going to go up 2%, and as a city manager, you say it's going to go up 3%, it gives you tens of millions of dollars more, so you can do the extra services council wanted. But the second you pass the budget, you know within 3 or 4 months as a department head, as a chief, they freeze your budget, they freeze all hiring, they stop all infrastructure, and that's what happened. They stopped all infrastructure replacement in the city of San Diego. A year before I became mayor, they repaved 1 mile a street out of 3,000 miles. And that's because they had to freeze all that the year before. So that's what happens when you have a city manager form of government. The budget's not really deliberated on in public. I mean, it's deliberated, but it's not. There's no tough questions. There's nobody asking that. With strong mayor, we had to bring the budget to the council and then present it publicly, and then fight and argue with council the whole time about what the priorities were going to be, how we were going to make ends meet. And we made a commitment we were not going to inflate any of the indicators. And so that reduced the amount that we had to do those sorts of things. Council was very cooperative. It doesn't mean we didn't fight. And a couple of council members said, I hate the city manager form of government. It was more collegial before. And I said, well, yeah, and you ran the train off the tracks because everybody got along great. That's not the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to have a spirited discussion about these things and do it in public so people can see what we're doing. And the council still rallied around, and we were able to do a lot of things. So we were able, during that 7-year period with different council members and all, to reduce retiree health care benefits, which is the deficit in that is every bit as big as the deficit in the pension system. So in public employees, no matter which government you're involved in, I don't care if it's Chula Vista, if it's the state of California, if it's the U.S. government, you promise lifetime health benefits for the employee. A lot of them promise lifetime health benefits for the employee and their spouse. Now, I just have to tell you, with the way medical costs have gone, that was never pre-funded, so there was no fund for that. And yet we knew we had a huge unfunded liability, about $1.4 billion. So the council, mayor's office, all worked on changing that system to a 401k-style retirement health care system, which you can do because retirement benefits aren't health care benefits aren't vested till the day you leave employment. You can't change a pension system because your retirement benefits are vested the day you start. So you can't change anything in that for the employees. You can change in the future for any new employees, which is what we did. But with the retiree health care change, we were able to save about $795 million over the next 20 years just by saying you're going to have to pay some end of that, and we're going to have 401k-style accounts. You can manage them however you want. And anybody with 25 years or more, we grandfathered in and said you simply have to pay a little bit for the rest of the time you're with the city. On the pension system, there's just no way. You can't get there from here. You see these cities going bankrupt, always because the pension system's out of whack. You cannot change the pension benefits, and the court will make that the first obligation you have. So that simply doesn't work, and it won't work. What we did was we went to a 401k style plan, probably the only city, I believe, in the United States to do that. And the reasoning behind that was our employees are no different than anybody else out in the general public, and almost everybody has 401k systems now. We do about a 13% match, which is very generous, but now there can never be an unfunded liability again because the city has to pay into that every single year into the future. So as employees leave and new employees come in, the new employees are on the 401k. That'll save between $1.2 billion and $2.1 billion over the next 30 years. So those are the things that we grappled with. We obviously had to reduce compensation for everybody from the mayor down for a period of time when the recession hit. We also ramped up the infrastructure improvements going out for bonds, $100 million at a time when we could afford the payments because we had built that into the budget. So you're seeing more miles of street being repaved and sidewalks and streets and all of that. So in 2012, December 4th, my favorite day of the year now, I was done in Stanley. It wasn't because of term limits. I was not going to run no matter what. I think it's an honor to serve. I'm really proud of the accomplishments the entire community put together to do. And I think that everybody had a tremendous impact on San Diego. But I always think change is good. I just think change is good. Now, the change we had wasn't good. Sometimes it takes you a couple times to get it right. But I think change is good. You need new leadership, and you need different leadership, and that's exactly what we're in right now. So my wife, when we ran the second time for office, and I always say we because it affected her as much as me, she said, "You can't run for the second term unless we have something to look forward to." And I said, "What would that be?" And she said, "3 months in Italy when you're done." So my wife always makes us save. Like when we had to buy a new flat-screen TV because we had 1980s models, we each had to put $50 in cash a week in a coffee can until we had enough money to buy that TV. So we each put $500 a month into an Italy account, and we left in January and had just the greatest time you can ever imagine in Italy for 3 months. We didn't take cell phones. She had an iPad. She wouldn't let me use mine. I wasn't allowed to read the paper. We used public transportation. We used buses and trains and went all over Italy for 3 months and had the best time you can possibly imagine. I had already started at the chamber, so I started a day after we got back from Italy in earnest, and I've been at the chamber now for about 8 months. And chamber's a very different existence, although it's somewhat political, and we're moving more to a policy-driven organization, one that is working with companies. We have 3,000 members in the San Diego Regional Chamber, largest chamber on the West Coast, represents about 400,000 employees. And, it runs the gamut from mixers for small business to get together and figure out how they interact with other people to very large events to some companies say, we don't care about your mixers. We don't care about your circles of influence. We don't care about any events. We want public policy done. So I hired my chief of public policy from the mayor's office. She's the number two person at the chamber now. She hired a couple of really smart public policy people, Chanel Hawken from the Airport Authority. She'd worked with Congressman Scott Peters. Paola Avila, who had been with Senator Benueso in the state Senate, and had also been deputy chief of staff to Mayor Murphy. So we have them now really pushing all the levers and getting that public policy out. And I think you've seen us take some positions the chamber hasn't taken in the past, like endorsing candidates. And we know that if we want a business-friendly environment that'll grow jobs, then we have to be out there. We have to make sure that people understand where we're at and what we'll do to create jobs in the city. So that's where we're at. Paola Avila moved from the policy side to a different policy position now. She's the head of our Mexico Business Center. So the chamber has basically three or four charges right now, and we've split them up with EDC and Connect. So we're not competing with each other. We've each taken different things. We handle military. We handle the border. We handle tourism, and we handle public policy. EDC handles job development. They handle the BRAC process with the military. And Connect handles the innovation economy. Together, we share lobbyists. We pool our money for lobbyists in D.C., and we share a lobbyist in Sacramento. That firm will be starting December 1st, next week. So we can really pay attention to what's going on in those places and try to stop some of the policy before it starts rolling downhill. And what we're trying to do is make sure that the business environment in San Diego allows for the development of jobs. And that's really what all this is about. It's about jobs development. We have 90,000 small businesses in San Diego. If each one of them could add one person because they felt comfortable with the economic environment, we could solve our entire unemployment problem just with that. So that's really what we're working on right now. So I'm having a great time, and I'd love to answer questions. And as I said before, there's literally almost nothing you can embarrass me about, unless you have pictures of when I was in college.
I can now appreciate why you were so effective as a mayor. You had a Jewish wife from Brooklyn.
Who is my advisor.
As I have. You spoke very glowingly about your police force and how it functions effectively. You did a model study on what would be effective. Has a model study ever been done about running a city or a county?
You know, I think there's been a lot of studies done. So, you know, let me kind of go into it this way. I'm not sure strong mayor is the best form, but I don't know another form that would work better. So what I would tell people, I was either the best person to be the first strong mayor or the worst person to be the first strong mayor. And the reason for that is I'd worked for the city for 26 years. I knew all the people in the city. And when I came in, we didn't wholesale change everybody. Kept the same police chief, kept the same fire chief, kept the same park and rec director, kept everybody. Now, it doesn't mean they all stayed after a period of time, but, you know, I felt that politics shouldn't enter into the operation of the city. Now, that's not to say it didn't. The change was before council members, our staff would go and talk to them and do whatever they wanted, and I finally told our staff, I'm really the only one you need to please, and I'm displeased at the moment. You have to work with us to let us know what you're going to do, and then we'll work with the council members to help you accomplish it. So that was a huge change in the way city operations were done. Now, I'm not sure, because we're seeing it now, and we will see it to some extent. You go to New York or Chicago, everybody turns in a resignation, and you come up with a whole new cast of department directors and police chiefs and all of that. You know, I don't know which the best model is, and I don't know anyone's really done a study because it's really politics. And it really depends on the individual that goes in there, and I think we saw that. So that's going to be borne out, I think, as we move through this. The city charter that they, the initiative, was very vaguely written. It didn't really separate out powers between council and mayor and all of that. And at first, I was really distressed because we'd say we had the power, and the council would say, oh, no, you don't. It doesn't say that in the charter. And actually, now that I think about it, it was probably an excellent process to have to go through. We negotiated every day, negotiated with the council, with the independent budget analyst, with the city attorney, with everybody. And I think it worked out pretty well, at least during our administration. And I think it will work out into the future. So I just don't know if those studies have been done.
Mayor Sanders, I'm Jerry Kent, and I want to thank you for your service to the city. I think you picked up a nightmare of a job, and you did a great job as our first strong mayor. I've been recently trying to understand the process of how governments deal with land use issues, and I was wondering if you could comment on the decisions and the process surrounding the Rock Church at Liberty Station, for which the precise plan does not include religious assembly, but was allowed with the CUP and then later on affirmed, if you will.
I think that probably so right now I'm an inch deep and a mile wide in my knowledge of stuff. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, which is the reason we had the great staff there. Land use is the most difficult, the most political, and it's also the least well thought out of any process in the city, at least in my estimation. No matter what you do, you're going to make somebody mad in land use. Rock Church. We had several churches that located in industrial areas, several churches located like the Rock Church did. And we would tell them, you can't locate there. That's not zoned for that. The U.S. Supreme Court got involved, said that they can. CUPs are very difficult to get, but there's also politics involved with all of that. The Rock Church is a huge church, and I know that that creates problems for some in the Liberty Station area because of the traffic congestion and just all of that. But I have to tell you, I think that church is there to stay. The church in Rancho Bernardo in industrial area is there to stay. We got sued over and over on these issues. The other land use issues, each community, there's 42 community planning areas that have a community planning board. And the one thing I found is that there is no community planning board that I'm aware of that wants anything else built in their community. Nothing. I mean, it's pretty natural. You like your neighborhood. You don't want to see it change. But things change. I mean, there's no way around that. That's one of the reasons we put so much density into downtown is because the neighborhood there doesn't mind that. In fact, they want more so that they start getting the amenities. But the community planning groups wield a lot of power. So the way it works is you go from a community planning group up to the planning commission, which makes a decision, and then over to the city council for a decision. Some are different tiers, so just the community planning group can approve. Some the planning commission can approve. Any significant type of land use is done by the city council. And let me just give you an example of that. The Barrio Logan community plan, very controversial. So for those of you who don't know what it is, we've had shipyards, we've had the Navy, we've had the port adjacent to Barrio Logan for probably 100 years. That's the reason the Navy came to San Diego. We have the only shipyards left on the West Coast. We have more than half of the U.S. Navy in San Diego Bay. We have the largest military presence of any city in the United States, even more than Washington, D.C., with the Marine Corps and the Navy. Barrio Logan and this community plan, which we started literally 7 years ago, took 7 years to get it to a place. And what finally came out of it was that they wanted to build residential within 500 feet of the shipyards and the Chevron tank farm and all of that. You can't do that. You literally cannot do that. What that would force is the shipyards to consider whether they're going to stay there, the Navy to consider whether they're going to stay there. And I have to tell you, I was with Todd Gloria, who I admire, and I mean, he's like a son to my wife and I in many ways. But I said, Todd, you're crazy bypassing this. You simply cannot do that. We were in Washington, D.C. meeting with the Secretary of Navy in October. And the Secretary of Navy gave Todd a letter that said, you cannot do this. The Navy will look elsewhere. They said, we left San Francisco when they encroached. We left Long Beach when they encroached. And we'll move to Bremerton, Washington if this goes through. And that's one of the reasons you've seen a referendum drive to overturn the city council decision, which was a 5-4 decision on that, because you literally, that's incompatible with the shipyards, which we absolutely need. The U.S. Navy, Department of Defense, and Marines, and defense industry is one out of every four jobs in the San Diego region. Literally one out of every four jobs. Just the Navy and that same group bring $32 billion a year into the San Diego economy. You can't have a hiccup where the Navy said, we have to leave. If they leave, the Marine Corps leaves because they have to be near the Navy to get shipped out. So those are the types of decisions, and they become really difficult. And then you have the high-rise construction, a lot of the other construction. It's always something that takes too long. Nobody will take a chance. And when you do take a chance and it doesn't go perfect, then you've created a huge monster. So the Rock Church is people who go there love it. People who don't go there don't love it. And I don't see that change any time in the future.
Hi, I'm Pete Levine. I wanted to thank you for your interesting insight. I've only been in San Diego now for about 14, 15 years. I love San Diego. I love the weather. But I am disheartened by politics. We've had some real blows since I've been in San Diego, and I'm just wondering how we're going to put out a better face or repair some of these problems that we've had with both city council and, of course, with the recent debacle in the mayor race.
Yeah, you know, it's my wife asks me all the time, what is it about San Diego that we elect mayors that either quit or get fired? What is it about city council members that get indicted? That, I mean, it's a mess. And I don't know what the answer is to that. I think the public is much more aware right at this moment of what they're doing in terms of questioning people, questioning candidates. But San Diego, I don't know how it compares to other places because I don't read the national news that often. But I have to suspect we're probably on the leading edge of disgrace a lot. And it took us literally 7 years to get our bond ratings back, to get out into the market, to change that Enron by the Sea label that was put onto us by the New York Times, and then to have it fall right back again in an even a worse way, literally 4 months after. I mean, it's just it's very distressing. So I just hope people really take an opportunity to get involved in. I think one of the things about San Diego, everybody's from somewhere else. So I'm not sure everybody pays as much attention to the local politics. Everybody reads the New York Times to find out what's going on in New York, read the L.A. Times to find out what's going on in L.A. I'm not sure they read about local politics as much as they probably should. I wasn't going to mention that.
My name is Reed Sullivan, and I want to move to a very important topic, which is sports. Now that it's done and we're several years into it, I guess my first question is there any question in your mind whether Petco Park was a good thing or a bad thing for the city of San Diego? And to follow on, would a football stadium downtown logically be necessarily a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, first of all, Petco Park is one of the best things the city's ever done. Now, if you're not a sports fan, you think, oh, God, I hate that stuff. Well, it's not what the sports team's about. It's not about the Padres. Petco Park brought in $7 for every dollar that was spent on that park. It downtown looks completely different today than it did 10 years ago. There was more high-rises, more residences, there's more office, there's more retail, there's more restaurants, there's more everything because of the development of that park in a bad part of downtown. All the studies have shown it was a 7-to-1 ratio of private investment after that. So I think it was an excellent thing. I think it's changed the face of downtown. It's also changed the face of the convention center, because it brought the restaurants and the hotels down to the convention center, which means the convention center is far more lucrative than it ever was. And that returns about $2.36 for every dollar put into it. So that's how we're exposed to the world also. I believe a football stadium would do exactly the same thing in the east end of downtown. Now, I don't know how many of you get downtown very often. Okay, if you go down to the east end, you're not walking there at night. You're not even going to walk there in the daytime. Very rough area. A lot of building starts, a lot of pipes sticking up out of the ground or a rebar, and it stops. And the economic environment did that, but it's also a tough place. I believe that a football stadium on the MTS site, which is the bus yard site, which is at the very epicenter of the bad part of downtown, would do exactly the same thing. We have an education center just to the north of that. City College, I don't know if you've seen, they're building out like crazy, and they're taking on added roles all the time. We have the Fashion Institute down there. We have the Institute of Architecture down there. All of a sudden, it's taking on a very different identity down there, and they want to build dorms, and they want to do all that, but they're not moving into areas that are still unsafe. We see the same thing when you start talking about the Idea Center. The Idea Center is several square blocks around about 9th and E and Market, and in that area, 10th, 11th. And that's where we're trying to get, we're trying to get a Google, one of those to bring in a campus there, because we know what we need is we don't just need retail. We need business that keeps people moving into that area and then walking to work and living in that area. That supports the retail. It supports the restaurants. Otherwise, it's a wasteland in the daytime, and at night you find quite a few people coming home. That's not enough to support a lot of these businesses. We had talked about building a ballpark there, and with that, we would put an entertainment corridor, much like LA Live, to the Petco Park and over to the convention center. And then I think you start to get that energy in the downtown that allows the office and the high-rise condos and high-rise apartments and all of that to actually function. I actually think it makes money at that point. The deals we had worked on with the Chargers and are still on the board, I don't know how actively anyone's working on it. I suspect not actively at all right now during a mayor's race. Was about county putting in about a quarter, city putting in about a quarter, Chargers putting in a quarter, and the NFL putting in a quarter. For that, then we get an energized downtown, which I think probably brings about a 7-to-1 return again. And people always get upset about downtown. Why does it get all the attention? Downtown drives the tax revenue. Downtown is what supports policing in our neighborhoods. It's what supports the fire department. It's what supports the park and rec. And it's also the only place you can actually go down and build more residential. It's supposed to hold 90,000 people by about 2030. It's at about 30, 35,000 right now. But that's the escape valve for the city, and then that creates the tax revenue and all that makes the rest of the city run for the neighborhoods.
Hi, I'm John Malugin. I was an early supporter of yours.
It's your fault.
Yeah. I'm glad I did it. I'm very glad I did it. Los Angeles has a campaign finance law. They match small donations of people, maybe 3-to-1, something like that. There's a movement in San Diego for one, two. I'm wondering, and that's just to give candidates a certain amount for either a mayor race, city council, or city attorney. I'm wondering, would you be in favor of a campaign finance scheme? And if so, do you have any ideas as to whether you like an L.A. model or a...
Well, I don't – first of all, the city of San Diego is not going to put any money into that. I mean, that comes at the expense of neighborhoods and streets and all of that. I do think it's gotten out of control. So I told you I had to raise $500,000 in primary, $500,000 in general. You cannot get elected now unless you raise about $1.5 million in a primary and more than that in a general. It's out of control. So lawsuits – started on this because the parties wanted to see, especially the Republican Party, wanted to see limits lifted off of council races and mayor's races. So now it's $1,000 an individual can give to a race, to an individual. But the political action committees, the independent expenditures have just skyrocketed. So in this last race, I know David Alvarez raised at least – in one reporting period, and I'm not sure what the final was, $1.7 million. Now, most of that came from labor unions. Nathan Fletcher raised $1.7 million, and that came from a variety of sources. And Kevin Faulkner raised about $1.2 million, and that came basically from business and from individuals. That comes from – a lot of the labor money comes from out of state. A lot of the other money comes from Sacramento and from other places. It's obscene to think about how much money is being spent in a mayoral race in San Diego now. And you can judge it. You can tell by the number of mailers you get at your house. It's crazy. And I know how much those mailers cost. So to mail a mailer to everybody in San Diego, every household that votes, $70,000. Now, they target much more differently now. So if you're a pure Republican household, two Republicans, then the Republican Party will send you something saying, we want you to be behind whoever. If you're a mixed household, my wife's a Democrat, I'm a Republican, we get everything under the sun. We get them from both sides. If you're independent, both sides are going to target you very specifically and send mailer after mailer after mailer after mailer. So if you're independent, you're getting barraged, and that is expensive stuff. And then when you start seeing TV ads go up, very expensive. So, I think something has to be done, but under the current constraints that the Supreme Court laid down and that a judge locally laid down, a federal judge, I don't know that it's going to be brought back under control. And I think you're going to find other cities, it's going to spread to them and it's going to start getting really expensive for elections. let me tell you, in politics, and I just want to be honest with you, it's all about money. All about money. You can be the smartest, best candidate in the world, and if you cannot raise enough money to get your message out, you don't stand a chance. So you have to be able to raise money in order to get the message out to people, whether it's television, whether it's mailers, no matter what. Otherwise, you simply can't get elected. And that was something. I came from an environment on the police department. We were never allowed to ask for anything. You couldn't ask for a free cup of coffee. You couldn't ask for anything, and you couldn't accept anything. To going into politics where you phone everybody in the entire city and the county and the state and beg for money, it was culture shock for me, and I think it's even worse now.
Yes, my name is Ira Nelson. Lately, there has been a lot of national, international news about two different mayors, one our ignominious mayor here, and lately our Mayor Ford in Toronto, who was, I guess, one might be ignominious, he might be ridiculous. But your presence here today has restored my faith in mayor position and reminds me of what it could be, so I want to thank you for that. But I also have another personal question for you. It is studies have indicated that marriages tend to last longer when the mates have similar backgrounds and similar, particularly religious and political backgrounds. You seem to be suffering a double whammy in that direction. So I'm wondering how you were able to preserve and your marriage has persevered with this this interesting combination. How do you get? Can we get along? How do you do that?
I simply have learned, yes, ma'am, and you're right. You know, I have to tell you, it has been, my wife and I have a tremendous partnership. And so when I was chief of police, she was the highest priced talent in the United States to hire as a consultant. I got it for free every night. She literally traveled 3 months out of the, 3 weeks out of the month going around the world on crime reduction, problem solving, and all those sorts of things. I got that for free. I'm pretty appreciative of that. I also got a lot of free advice when I was mayor I didn't always agree with. But, you know, I think we just enjoy being with each other, so it's a lot of fun. Now, on the other part, my staff used to call me the world's most boring mayor. And they said, we're really happy you are boring. So, I the Toronto mayor, that's quite a story. And my wife tortures me with this stuff. When Filner was still there, every night I'd come home and she'd have all the research done for the entire day. Because she's not gone back to work yet. She's still on Italy time. And I said, you either have to go back to work full time or you have to volunteer full time, but you can't be on Filner watch full time.
Well, that was a fantastic last question, and you're not a boring mayor. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.